Sorry, let's try that again. Alright, this is Talk Is Cheap. I found the album that I was looking for last week, which was an interview with Robert Fripp and Andy Summers. So you're going to hear a few commercial police songs that isn't really what we do here. But it's interesting, a lot of interesting stuff on Andy Summers and Robert Fripp. For instance, Robert Fripp met Andy Summers because that's where he used to take his Mellotron to be repaired, was at the shop that Andy Summers used to work at. And as you'll find out, one of the most popular songs in the world is actually a Fripp chord progression. So that's coming up here on Talk Is Cheap. It's an hour-long interview on an album, so you'll hear me turn the album over. But other than that, I'm gonna just strictly stick to the album. So a special edition of Talk Is Cheap this week. And next week is Environmental Law Conference. So stay tuned for that. On KEPW 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Low Power FM.
So would you like to describe what it is that's going on here and where we are and when we are?
A good point. Starting with who we are, my name is Vic Garbarini, and I'm executive editor of Musician Magazine. The fellow at the opposite end of the large pink table, signing strange lithographs, which are about to become the cover of his new album, is Robert Fripp.
Hello, team.
You can hear that pen scratching in the background.
This is what's called art.
Abstract art for those listening on the radio, but art nonetheless.
I don't do this for a living. I do it for art's sake.
And Art himself is not here, but in his place is young Andy Summers.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Quite
did
well. For all three titles.
Did you actually find the magazine with the article Sex and the Rock and Roll Star, in which you're, may I say, heavily featured? Did I tell you this?
Thank you for striking this low note at the beginning of this art interview, Robert. I did. And I'm still here.
What was your reaction to that comment?
In the
article?
Pride.
Understandable. You two have just completed your second duet album together, the Summers Fripp album, or Fripp Summers album, depending mm-hmm. on which end of the album.
Frommers Sip.
The
Sip Frommers, you know, any way you like.
Exactly. why would people, two people with such obvious problems as you two have, decide to work together in this creative format?
I couldn't find no one else that let me work with them, see? So I said to my mate Andy, Andy, let's go down to Arnie's. Let's go down to Arnie's hut and make us a record.
Now, for those Americans listening in the college audience who wonder why Robert is talking like this, I should say that one of the things I know about these two is they come from the same part of Perfidious Albion. That is, they come from the same county of England, being the County Dorset. Now, is that a real Dorset accent we're hearing there?
That's what's known as gilding the lily.
It is. I'd say no. And that is a real Dorset accent. John Wetton, who is now a member of Asia, when he was 15 or 16, and also living in Bournemouth, and in a band called Palmer James, with Palmer James, would go off to country lanes and shout to each other from one side of the road to the other, all right, going well, all right.
Wonderful music background they have together.
Yes, I think people have
common
to understand
soil.
They didn't have MTV in those days.
Yes.
Okay, where that can be done for you. So you both came from that roughly the same area down there, around Bournemouth.
This is true.
When did you meet each other? Did you ever interlock as musicians or in any
other
strange way?
No, I can tell you what happened. Andy was working in Minns, and I went in for some... Minns was a music shop in Bournemouth, since bankrupt by the most appallingly dinosauric policy. They had... A friend of mine was managing it until they sold out shortly ago. They had a whole pile of redundant, really awful, feeble, cheap organs.
Well, we're all cursed with this, aren't we?
and
I have to check the magazine for that, Andy. Yes,
they used to do a lot of good business selling them to the middle class of Bournemouth. And the middle class of Bournemouth either ran out of money or improved its taste or read about new technology. Anyway, going back to...
When I was a lad.
When Andy was there, like, I went in and asked him a question, and he was rude to me, insouciant.
This story continues to haunt me through the years.
Well, you shouldn't have been so rude then.
I know. But to pick up the story here, the thing is, I was working at the Majestic Hotel in the guitar seat, let's say, working for the Hebrew fraternity of Bournemouth. When I finally vacated to go to London, who should take my place? Young Mr. Fripp, who of course was to go on to London and assume much larger fame and fortune than I in the early term.
And bigger shoes, if I remember.
Oh, bigger shoes.
Yeah. One thing I've always been curious about, at that great time of transition, now lost in the mists of history, what kind of tunes were you guys...
No, it was last year.
What kind of tunes were you guys playing? In the hotel. Give us a little
playlist. You shout out the ones you played, then I'll shout out the ones
I think we used to do Perfidia, the Jewish National Anthem, and Happy Birthday, Sweet 16. Those are the three I knew the chords of.
Mm.
The rest I had a red face on.
I used to do all the Jolsons, the fast Jolsons and the slow Jolsons. Hava Nagila. All the wedding songs.
Harbour Banana.
And if you were doing, I mean, if you were doing a bar mitzvah, then obviously the music was a bit different. But I was responsible for what the band called The Twists.
Mm.
Have you got any twists, Bob? They used to say to me. And every now and then I would go out and buy some sheet music to a new twist and write it out for them.
Stunning.
I still have occasional nightmares about it.
Anyway, look, Andrew.
Yes?
Looking at Robert, signing away there, busy as a little bee.
What a job he's making of it.
What was it about his playing that made you reach out for him, as they say in the Mafia, the first time you decided to do a duet album like this? What was it about his compatibility or the difference in his playing? Or why Robert?
Why Robert, indeed. Well, the serious answer to that, I suppose, is, you know, like how as you go through life and there's something you're aware of all the time and then suddenly it leaps into focus and you're enlightened. Well, I heard his solo on, and I've quoted this before, on the, what was that tune, that marvellous tune on the Roaches album that he
Hammond's
produced.
Oh, the Hammond song.
He produced a marvellous heartrending solo on that, which suddenly lit me up to him and his works. And I'd listened to what he did with David Bowie, which I enjoyed very much. I thought it was terrific. And I was at the time anyway, was looking for something to do outside of the Police, like a guitar duet, something that could be hopefully wouldn't interfere with my activities with the Police and would be sort of rewarding musically, and really a completely different kettle of fish in terms of commercial pressures. And I like the idea of trying to do a very sort of 1980s guitar duet kind of album. So I wrote a letter to Robert from the Munich Hilton. When I got back to England, I was told that he had responded with some enthusiasm. Of course, eventually we managed to get together and talk this over. I think it was at my parents' house at Christmas in 1980, September 81, we finally got together and made the album. And of course, that was the start of this sort of Laurel and Hardy career we've pursued since.
Now, one of the things that I'm sure our avid and attentive listeners have noticed about the difference between the first album and this one is that on the first album, we had the term duet was very appropriate for that. There were clearly two guitar parts mm-hmm. there interacting. Now, on the second album, the format has been shifted quite a bit. The first side is sort of dance-oriented and very minimalist, and the second side is remarkably fluid, and it's sometimes hard to tell who's doing what. If you had to define, even though you're both, in a sense, equals on the album, if you had to define how your responsibilities were divided in terms of, does one person play a particular type of sound, particular role or responsibility, how does that work?
Yeah, I think you could say that to some extent.
No, it's
not
it's,
totally.
No, it would be inaccurate to say that this was an equal album. I was there for 2.5 weeks and then had to leave for the Crimson Tour and leave Andy to finish it. So I think it's only fair to Andrew to say that the album is a lot more Andrew than it is me.
Half a Fripp is better than none, though.
Yes, I think it would be unfair for me to claim half the value of the album. That's not true.
Okay, but I'm talking in terms of when you're both playing on a particular tune. Is there an instinctive
tendency for one of you to go one way, another,
another?
Yeah, I think, you know, to make a sort of give you some sort of idea, if you have a body which is composed of flesh and bones, then maybe you could say Robert provides the bones and I provide the flesh. But this isn't. This is a real generalization. I don't think this is true of every track we've ever recorded. But I think that's a fair comment on the way we do it. Robert will come up with a lot of sort of single line polyrhythmic riffs, and I will supply the harmonies around them.
For instance, on the new album now, I still have the original cassette you gave me, which doesn't have any of the tunes listed on it. So the thing on the second side that sounds almost Spanish or Moorish. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a hammer.
Yeah, that really impressed me. Now, there's one guitar going through with a with a sort of arpeggiating slowly and stately, and then there's a fluid guitar in the middle.
That's my new standard guitar tuning.
Now, on the tune in question that we're talking about, what's the title on that, by the way?
Maquillage.
Really?
Yeah.
Andy chooses the titles. I never know what songs are what. I really don't. Never
well,
do.
Yeah, it does get confusing, you know. It almost actually makes a mess of the, let's say, the production part of the album, because you work so long for, like, these ridiculous, stupid titles you make up, working titles you go through, and everybody's referring to that, and then you kind of get your sort of real titles for the album sleeve, and... But everybody's thinking then, I remember that all this, like, trying to tell them to master one tune when they had it and they got really confused. It does get confusing.
What does maquillage mean?
Actually, what it means is, I think it's French. It means makeup. There's implications, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Really?
Thank you.
Now, all right, since we happen to be working this one over, did that Robert, did your part come first? Did you come into Andy with that simple outline?
That's the case, yes.
And then Andrew, you just...
But what Robert did do, which was nifty, because actually of all, most of this material was made up in the studio. We did have a little rehearsal period a few months before, which really didn't get onto the album, apart from this one tune. Robert, as you may remember, where we were playing it, because it had a kind of film feeling to it, this one, and Robert was playing it and I was trying to construct a melody over it, but what he did in the studio finally, which was pretty nifty, was to remove a note, which put it into 7/4, which made it a lot more interesting. And then I merely improvised over the top of it.
The guitar synthesizer, both of you now, are using guitar synthesizers on and off, and I think in the washes of sound we hear on the second side of the album, it seems to be very predominant. Andy, the first time I remember hearing you use a guitar synthesizer, I think was on "Do Do Do Do" with the Police. That sort of, is that where there's that break where there's a chordal wash, or is it "Don't Stand"?
Don't Stand So Close to Me. Yeah.
Okay, now. The track that, when I heard Synchronicity, that I thought was one of the most beautiful uses of a guitar synthesizer was Tea in the Sahara, but that wasn't really a guitar synthesizer.
No, actually, there's no. It's all done with a Stratocaster and an Echoplex.
How did you get that liquid smear sound?
I think the way I did it, I mean, because on that track, the three of the group were all in different rooms, so I was able to turn up extremely loud, and you know, you're on the brink of feeding back, so it starts to kind of wobble. It's not quite sure which way to go. I mean, it literally depends on whether you turn to face the amplifier. You have to stand physically in the right spot of the room. It's very crucial. Played very loud and used a volume pedal, and really, literally, the way I held my hands on the string and shifted the chord position right at the moment where it was about to, like, start feeding back.
Mm-hmm.
It was I aged about 10 years doing that track.
Now, when you say that you were all in three different rooms, was because of personal hygiene problems in the band? Or was there a
physical
musical
and mental,
that?
Yeah.
I see.
Hygiene problems. No, actually, I mean, to be honest, in Montserrat, the best sounding room for the drums is actually the dining room, which is a great long sort of wooden room, and we'd actually just cleared the entire space, and Stuart had his drums there because it was the best room to get the live sound, much better than studio. Sting likes to play through the board, and I was able to just line up my six amplifiers against one wall and, like, choose whichever combination at will and blast forth.
Now, one of the things another one of my as a critic, I have a responsibility to make idiotic theories, of course, and one of the ones I've come up with is just looking at you two working over the past 2 or 3 years and feeling that you have influenced each other. I think some of Robert's work has become more fluid, mm-hmm. and I notice Andy working in some of the odd time signatures that you first started doing on iAdvanced Mass. For instance, Mother on the Police album.
is ringing. Is that my mother on the phone?
That come out of, do you feel, out of some of the work you've been doing with
Robert? Well, I must, yeah, there is a little in-joke there, which never offended Robert, I hope. But,
not at all.
Good.
Not at
all. I mean, this is what it's about, interacting and everything. I guess actually the riff, as it's in 7, it does sound very frippish, let's say. Frippesque?
Frippian,
yeah, I like that. But the solo in particular, which I played on that track, which was actually quite difficult to pull off because the chords changed and it's in 7-4 time, I had to sort of work it out. But it starts out as a imitation. It starts out as an imitation of a solo that Robert played, I believe, on... Is it
Another Green World, isn't it?
Another Green World. Is it on Fire Island?
Eno's titles always used to throw...
Well, it was a track that Robert recorded with Brian Eno a few years back. A solo I particularly liked.
Just after midnight in Island Number 2, actually, with Rhett Davies engineering.
Well, there you go.
Just before I was just leaving to go to Sherborne. There you are.
So I thought it was a nice little... I started off my solo quoting Robert, and for the cognoscenti, as they had known the two albums that Robert and I were, there was a little joke there. So that's the story on that.
It's Frank and Alice Cognoscenti in Columbus, Ohio.
Frank and Ernest. Yeah.
Oh, Ernest, that's right. Yeah, they went through some changes in the 70s.
Both Frank and Ernest.
I thought they were fishmongers from Battersea.
Well, they probably
are. Yes. Of course, the biggest song of last year, and a lot of people would say the biggest single of the decade so far, was Every Breath You Take. And, of course, Sting wrote the song, and it's a simple sort of 50s-60s chord pattern, but the guitar figure in there, if I'm not mistaken, and I know I'm not because you told me this once before, the guitar figure and the way it was formatted came from you, and didn't that come from something you were working on out of Bartok and out of Fripp Summers or something that was somehow changed or altered for that song?
Yeah, in between finishing the album with Robert and then going on to record another Police album, but thinking about doing another album with Robert, I was, you know, in my various sessions with myself in the kitchen where I live, you know, playing into a tape recorder, I was working on one of those little riffs that we'd done on the first album, which is the sort of Painting and Dance it was called.
All right, you're listening. This is a special episode of Talk is Cheap. You're listening to an interview with Robert Fripp and Andy Summers. Don't usually play, just to show you the most popular song of all time, actually of Robert Fripp, chord progression. All right, so this is exactly an hour, so that's why you're listening to me turn the album over. So here, continuing on with Andy Summers and Robert Fripp. And this is, you can hear the precursor, a lot of this is a precursor to 80s King Crimson. This was done in like 78, early 80s, while they were still doing King Crimson Discipline. Thanks for listening. KEPW 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks, low power FM.
And one for the second. That's perceptive.
I think there's a connection there. I think there's something being said on an archetypal level.
Really? What was this? There's some great photos from the session.
I photographed Robert at the video shoot in London last week. I have some marvelous photographs of you, Robert, that I took. And I may be able to lay them on you before you leave for Washington.
Wonderful. Where are they now?
They're down the road, not very far away. I'll make a call.
Let's all go there right now.
We'll go there after the interview and vibrate together.
All right.
Want to know something about this video?
Yes.
It was hilarious. It was also very, very hard work because it was running a day late. So instead of finishing 8 o'clock in the evening after a long day's shooting, we simply went on till 7 the following morning.
Oh.
But it was amazingly funny. It was amazingly funny. There was one particular scene where Andy is bringing me tea. Should I paint in a larger background?
Oh, please, give us a synopsis.
It was filmed in the Holloway Sanitarium, which was built in 1877 for the curably insane middle class of England. It's now on the market for £6 million in 25 acres. Only one of the eight buildings is a huge brick church. One of the intriguing things when you walk in through the entrance hall is the paintings done by the London School of Art, I believe, in 1900. And although I don't think they realised what they were doing, they were painting a whole scene of demons all over the walls.
It's unbelievable.
It's really horrible and profoundly disturbing. And anyone with any sensitivity at all, let alone someone who's having a little difficulty with their mental life, finds it utterly unnerving. However, you go on from that into the hall with pastoral scenes painted around on the panels around the room, where the long table was set up. Myself, in the role of master of the house, was unmovable and unprovocable and deadpan, while Andrew the butler tried to provoke me and live my pan. There was this one particular scene where Andrew is bringing me my tea past the monkey riding on the donkey.
That's right.
Past Gene October in the role of a junkie slumped in a large chair with the stuffed black bear hovering over him with a live sheep tied to his chair. And there was also a goat on a table eating the Times, and when it finished the Times, I gave it the Guardian. The camera was on a dolly, which is a little railway, moved along as Andrew came, and the different animal handlers were holding the animals, and as the camera approached, they would let them go and run to get out of shot. I was also given tarantula crackers to eat. Fortunately, the tarantulas were dead. However, they were very real tarantulas, and they were placed in cream cheese on crackers. One thing I didn't know was that the hairs from the legs of tarantulas fall off, and they fell into the cream cheese.
Show business.
I'm speechless myself, actually.
The little monkey.
Sort of a microcosm of the music business, in a sense, a mini universe.
I think we made a statement.
Yeah. Do the animals get residuals for the further?
Well, they left residuals.
Oh, they left residuals.
The fox fell asleep at midnight.
The saddest part was we had a baby pig that was supposed to make an appearance. The pig, there is a happy note to this. The pig lay there all night and was waiting to come on, you know, and do its bit. But it was dying, and it was out the back, wrapped in black cloth.
At 4 o'clock in the morning, the message came through, the pig is dying.
Yeah. But the pig, we were all very happy to say, lived. It was only 6 months old, Piglet. The pig made it, so...
It was only 5 weeks, it hadn't been weaned.
Oh, was it? Yeah, 6 weeks. Yeah, 5 weeks,
Five weeks, it hadn't been weaned.
Yeah, it was terrible. But anyway, the pig lived. We're very happy about that.
Actually, isn't there... There's a bit of a story about the first video where... Robert, didn't you make sort of a facetious remark about what the first video needed, which then came to pass?
Yes, what happened was I was at World Headquarters in Wimborne, Fit World Headquarters, and I was just off on a Crim tour, an endless King Crimson tour somewhere or other, and I phoned up Andy, and Andy said, we have to do a video, have you got any ideas? And I said, yes, how about half a dozen Oriental dancing girls, with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek? And Andy said, what a great idea. I went away on tour, came back, phoned Andy up to see what was happening, and the first thing Andy said was, I've got the Oriental dancing girls. And sure enough, I turned up in London to film the video, and there they were, one complete with koto.
I beg your pardon?
Complete with koto.
Oh, yeah.
Small Japanese, yeah.
I thought it was...
Yes.
That video is actually seen in this video, we might add.
That
we
video.
Show it during the running of this video. Now, has that ever been done before?
Good technical point here. I don't think so.
These are the only two videos which I've ever done that I'm remotely interested in. The videos I've done embarrass me and humiliate me generally.
I don't know you've done any, Robert. Have you done them? What,
Yes.
You don't mean the pretentious, silly ones that have been done for King Crimson, do you? I'll rephrase that. You don't mean the... you mean the King Crimson videos you're not happy with.
I very much like the I Advance Mask video because it's very, very silly. Very humorous.
It's nice. It's exciting, actually. I was really excited to see it.
Great music. Great music.
The music really happening.
But this current one, I think, will set
new standards. Yeah.
Robert, do you really feel more comfortable and more able to let fly, as Andy said, when you're working in a project which isn't directly involved with Crimson, a band that you feel responsible for?
I find it utterly impossible to play well in Crimson.
Current incarnation.
It's always been the same.
Mm. And why is that?
What I've always tried to do within Crimson is to have a band, a group, which is not really a reflection of the four individuals. It simply has an identity of all of its own. And I think that Crimson in 81 came close to that idea, although the penny hadn't fully dropped all around the team. But it was there as a possibility. But I think after 81, there were elements within the group that found this frustrating and wished, if you like, a higher level of self-expression. So it wasn't really a group. And within a situation where individuals are going for themselves,
I think it's the same in any group, really. Any group that gets anywhere and is noted for doing anything at all, it's just one of those things. You tend not to embrace it, but to revile it, or you carry on. But at the same time, you to some extent feel trapped, and you want to become known for other things or doing something else.
So the implication is a certain amount of creative fiction is useful, but it can cross a certain invisible line where it begins.
It brings something else with it. Yeah,
it's called egotism. Where you get egotism, everything breaks down.
But all the best groups are rife with egotism.
Police is a very volatile group. I mean, you have three very distinct personalities, and I'm sure there's a lot of pushing and pulling. And isn't it true that for instance, that you yourself have a lot to do with arranging the Police songs? We talked about Every Breath You Take and so on. I mean, people think of Sting as the songwriter, and yet those songs don't always sound the way we hear them on the radio when they're first
received.
No,
I mean, over the 6 years or whatever we've been recording. I mean, what finally gets on a record, there's often considerable change from the demo to the original idea to what finally goes down on a record. I mean, it's like anything. I mean, I think editing and constructing is almost as creative as writing the original piece, because it can become so different. And you sort of take the base material, which you obviously need, and you transform it into something else.
For example, we mentioned Every Breath You Take. Can you give us another example of a song that people might be familiar with that started out in a very different incarnation before we heard it the way it is?
Yeah, like The World Is Running Down, for instance, which was, although I thought the lyrics were great, Sting had nothing like what we finally came up with. It was like this sort of disco song with different chords and everything. And I know there was quite some friction in the studio with that particular piece. And we worked through it and we finally came up with it. Without bragging overly, I mean, if I hadn't put those chords on and put the guitar sound that is so characteristic, it wouldn't have sounded anything like it is now.
If you wish to brag overly, you can go ahead.
Well, I will, but the minute I came up, I put the sound on and those chords, Stuart's drumming, it all felt like it was just like the key. And within 5 minutes, we'd recorded it. It was just like instant. It just needed that key, and so on and so forth.
Thank you.
Right, there's the old story that I remember Sting and Secret Policeman's Ball played Roxanne as a bossa nova. Now, that was the way it was originally written.
That's right, yeah.
And then what happened to turn it into what it was?
Oh, I guess this was in the period, early days, when we were rehearsing in a gay hairdresser's basement up in Finchley, I remember. A very damp, cold, mildewed basement in the depths of winter. And he liked Stuart, I remember this. But anyway, there we were, and we started to fool around with Roxanne. He'd had, as I remember, just the verse, and we kept playing with it. Sting always denies this, but I remember Stuart kind of teaching him where to put the bass line, because Stuart was more into the reggae thing than Sting was at that point. Anyway, I mean, this is not to belittle Sting. I mean, he's a fantastic
musician.
It's
not a question of belittling. It's just a question of.
God's sake.
All of this, you know, goes into the great maw of, you know, the band.
It's all being in a group, I think, and any group that's any good is rife with these things. Any group that really gets along, I think that has to be suspect. I just don't think, the best stuff comes out of, you know, conflict of personality. I mean, as long as the talent is there with it, but people...
You need to share. If the group is going to work, it needs to have the same aim.
That's
otherwise,
right.
You're looking at mechanics. Mike Giles, the first drummer in King Crimson, always used to say there's three things which keep a group together. The social life between the members, the money they make, and the quality of the music. And any two of them will keep the band together.
Fortunately or unfortunately.
Yes. If you share the same aim for the group, it's possible to overcome almost anything. But if there is a difference of aim, then the smallest issues become really, really
large. I think,
like,
that's about the truest thing you can say.
If the white wine afterwards isn't quite cold enough, or if it isn't quite cold enough, you can't really, really drink it over plastic glasses. These become very, very weighty issues. For example, if you're in a group and your aim is to have a group spirit, and maybe another member of the group's interest is to have a vehicle for them, you're going to run into problems. You do not have the same aim. You do not share the same aim.
Do some of the same creative tensions arise in when you're working together as a duo? I mean, you both have very different styles, and yet obviously you've made something larger than the sum of the parts out of it. Was it much easier than working in your individual groups? Was it harder, or was it simply different?
Well, I left after 2.5 weeks.
Yes.
That's the quick answer.
The other album too. I mean, we're talking two albums here.
Oh, I stayed for that one.
We've not had to go through the chore, well, not the chore, but the trauma of being on the road or trying to do that together. I think we both liked the idea of working together and doing this because maybe we would be able to work in a sense where we were free of all those things. Yeah. Well, I was going to say I haven't got anything to do with the creativity, but I just said that it did. I think we
both
come out of... You
mean you just contradicted yourself?
I just contradicted myself. We both come from those situations that we were just talking about, and I think... So we get like a third thing, which is, or a second thing, whereas we're very happy to be working together and out of that, and you get this kind of freedom that goes with that, hopefully.
Fooling around, as it were. Being irresponsible.
Being completely indulgent.
Being silly and expecting people to spend their hard-earned money on this.
We do have a laugh when we're recording, and we go off. Robert Hatt and I had a very nice little routine of we'd meet in the morning, and we'd have some coffee, and we'd sort of talk about what we'd done the day before, listen, fool around, do a bit of sketching out the new arrangement, and then we'd go off and have...
Oh, one thing we have to say at this point is we're talking in the morning. I would go across to the little homemade cake shop opposite and bring back a green cake. Bright, livid green.
Would bring back me a green cake.
It had cream in the middle.
Loaded
but you know
with
what?
White sugar, I might add.
It's changed ownership.
Oh, my God.
And they do not make lime, livid, luminous green cakes.
Well, in that case, I don't think we'll be recording any more albums.
I was afraid of that, yes.
But I must continue the story, because then we go to the salad bar and have our health food lunch. Then we'd go to the antiquarian bookshop and probably buy a book each and mull for an hour, and then we'd go back and carry on recording. See how simple and uncomplicated we are.
Very artsy, yes.
What we would do every day.
Since you mentioned coming into this project after both of you had been touring for quite some time and how it was a nice change of pace, you both come from bands that do a great deal of touring. Are there any plans for the two of you to take this little show on the road and give the great people of America a chance to hear what you sound like live?
We've talked about it, and I would love to do it, actually, because I think we'd actually have a lot of fun. bringing our experience to bear on the situation and trying to avoid all those previous traumas that we've talked about. I think it would be a very nice thing to do. However, both Robert and I have several commitments, so it's just trying to find the time to do it.
I don't know whether we'd agree on the same way of doing it. There you are.
We may not.
And I think your manager's ideas would probably be remarkably.
There are three ways, really. We can either do it as a duet, like with two guitars, or we could try it as the two of us plus one guy filling in and running tapes that we could play against, or we could put a group together to carry off this music.
Mm-hmm.
And I would far rather two guitarists.
That would be the most fun. Whether we would be able to make it sound anything like the album is another.
Doesn't matter.
Maybe we.
No, I think it's the chemistry itself that would probably come through anyway. Yeah. Well, all right. Let's look at that for a minute. You both do have a lot of commitments, and
I don't. No, I'm just going into retreat, and I shall then let the future present itself.
So, are we to deduce from that there is no more Crimson as of right now, or is that just
there
an
advance? There are tapes of a live album to be mixed in February.
But you're not planning on working in a band format immediately in the future again?
There are no plans for that.
All right. Andy, what about you? Aren't you involved in some film projects now?
Yeah, I am. I'm just going to trip out to LA, actually, tomorrow or Saturday to see about another one. But I'm actually going to write a screenplay. That's the next sort of project for me. And I have three films I could score in January, February, and I just have to decide which one. Actually, just as we're here with Robert, something interesting has come up, Robert, which I must tell you about. Last summer I read a script.
Mm-hmm.
They are now considering using the music from the two
really?
Albums for all the music.
Really?
The film. Yeah, and I'm pushing for that because I think that would be very nice.
That's great.
So that's something that's
yeah.
being talked about daily at the moment, and they're very keen. The director loved Iron Advanced Mask, so yeah, film projects really mostly for me. A live album with the Police over December.
You're going to be a film star?
Well, I don't know. See, the world will decide. I am in my own mind, of course.
I
certainly in my mother's mind.
I reckon you'd be great. Number one.
What about, wasn't there a jazz-oriented album that you were planning on for a while? Is that going
yeah,
to
with Jack DeJohnette. We've talked about that many times. And I think he's getting a little frustrated because I haven't actually been able to get to it, but I would love to do that with him. And I actually have some very good tunes that I think would work with him.
And if I'm Cameron Crowe, who wrote Fast Times at Ridgemont High, sent me a tape just the other day with a little star beside a certain song that you had done that's going to appear
that's
on
right.
an upcoming soundtrack.
That's right. I did a song. Actually, in the same studios where we recorded these, Robert and I have recorded these two albums, a song called Human Shout, and that's in this movie.
Which is, what is it?
It's called The Wildlife.
And that will be coming out. When will people
coming
be
out
hearing
soon, any day now, I think.
Speaking of things coming to the surface, and great deal of work and preparation being put into things, and spontaneous eruptions and so on, I think we should end the interview the way we started just before we came on the air here, and Robert was asked to say something into the microphone, and a spontaneous duet erupted between the two of you. And on the count of three, I was wondering if you could reproduce that. One.
What was that, Robert?
Had something to do with the
two,
bard.
Three. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention.
A kingdom
for
a
stage. And princes to act, and monarchs to behold their swelling scene.
Thank you, gentlemen, Robert Fripp and Andy Summers.
KEPW 97.3 FM. Show's Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti. So yeah, that was from 1979, I think. Anyway, pre-80s Crimson interview. Interesting to me how a band's architecture or decisions are a lot like the consensus process. You have to have an affinity for that. And Andy Summers, the least popular member of the Police, possibly the greatest member of the Police. You notice that one song, what he did was play as loud as possible to get the sound that he wanted without feedback. So, anyway, yeah. All right, so it was less than an hour, so I had a little time. Yeah, next week I'll be broadcasting from the Environmental Law Conference, so I hope you check that out. What else? Yeah, you'll hear a lot of stuff like that on Talk is Cheap. I've got an archive of stuff that I've recorded around town, around L.A. also. I guess tonight or tomorrow, I'm going to probably go to this Time Bank discussion, 1645 High Street at Eugene Garden Club, noon to 3 p.m., Sunday, February 24th, a community potluck and time banking discussion. So I'm going to try and record that, and I'll play that in the future. Yeah, support independent media. Just been looking at Mordecai Vanunu betrayed the secret of Israel's nuclear weapons program. Israel still is not, I have nothing against Israel per se, but they have still not admitted that they have nuclear weapons. When I was a kid, no one in the Middle East was supposed to have nuclear weapons because they would basically destroy the entire world if any of them, they would destroy themselves if they launched any of them and destroy the entire world. So no one in the Middle East is supposed to have nuclear weapons. And I noticed they just don't mention that anytime they talk about Iran, nuclear weapons, and now Saudi Arabia wants nuclear weapons. They just don't talk about Israel has what's called an ambiguous nuclear weapons deployment. They have them. Everybody knows they have them, but they won't admit that they have them. So at least come out and admit that you have nuclear weapons. Okay, so that's it. I got this one little thing for you. I may go over a little bit here, but this is Alan Holdsworth from the Road Games Tour. I just found this in my collection that I didn't... Dime a Dozen is a great place to download stuff, too. And shout out to Cafe Kush over there. They do their open mic night. Hoping to get an interview with them. Yeah. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. KEPW 97.3. Eugene Peaceworks Low Power FM. Also simulcast on KEPW.org.